चारोकाधिपति सहम्पति कर्णान् चारीयान् धीवरां अयाचथ सन्ति सन्ता परचखचातिका थे से तु धम्मं अनुकम्पिमं पशं।
नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. The Buddhist teachings were referred to by the Buddha himself, either as the Brahmacharya, the holy life, or else is the Dhamma Vinaya. And this word Dhamma Vinaya is a very interesting and important word because it makes very clear that the Buddhist teachings do not encourage a turning away from the world or an indifference to external conditions. Now, there's nowhere that I've found, in any case, that the Buddha says just withdraw into yourself and make your mind peaceful, and if everyone does that, then the society and the world will be okay. The Buddha taught the Dhamma, which are the teachings concerning the development of the heart and of wisdom, the citta bhavana and the banya bhavana. But he also taught the vinaya, which concerns called kaya bhavana and sila bhavana, development of one's relationship to the material world and one's relationship to the social world. And the vinaya consists of training rules, regulations, conventions, which are intended to facilitate the practice of Dhamma, to create those conditions most conducive for the effective, successful practice of Dhamma. So there is a recognition here that some conditions are conducive and some conditions are not conducive, and that part of practice is, as far as it is possible, to do so to create those conditions which are most conducive to the waning of akusala dhammas, the waxing of kusala dhammas, the purification of the mind. Now that applies both in the monastic environment, or for a layperson at home, in their families, and also in the workplace and in the society at whole. And for the lay Buddhist community, it calls for effort to try to create a society which is conducive to growth in Dhamma, a society which praises and supports goodness. A society which discourages cruelty, heedlessness. In the Buddhist society, we have a division of responsibilities, and in certain areas, the lay people look to the monks as example and monastics as exemplars. But in other cases, they do not. For instance, monks refrain from all political involvement. But that does not mean that lay Buddhists, therefore, should deduce that Buddhism is indifferent to the political universe, or that one should withdraw from all political involvement. Far from it. The reason that Buddhist monks refrain from political partisanship is that their role is to be a refuge for all beings, and in all human beings, beings of all political persuasions. And this is the role that the Sangha has performed historically in Theravada countries. The ideal being that those of every social class and every political persuasion can meet as friends and equals in the monastery. They can, for the time being, forget that they are of a right-wing persuasion or a left-wing persuasion or a radical persuasion or a moderate persuasion, that they are rich, that they are poor, and they come together as beings sharing a common predicament of facing old age, sickness and death, recognizing that the things we have in common far outnumber and outweigh the things that make us different, and all with a respect for each other as human beings seeking to transcend dukkha and suffering, to find true meaning and happiness in life. So if monks were to become involved in politics or particular political issues, it would immediately have a bearing on the harmony of the Sangha. And the harmony of the Sangha is given paramount importance in the Buddha's teachings, to the extent that the Buddha said that if someone was to actively promote disharmony in the Sangha and create schism in the Sangha, then the karmic consequences of that would be equal to that of killing one's father or mother or killing an arahant. And this isn't just a teaching that the Buddha devised to impress upon people the importance of we call Sangha Samaki, but we believe that he was speaking from his deep, profound knowledge of the law of karma and of the different realms of being. So creating a schism in the Sangha is a truly fearful thing to be involved in, and it would be inevitable, wouldn't it, that although monks might share common views about the practice of Dhamma, they might well disagree on social and political issues. And you might find within, say, a monastery in America, you might find a democratic group and a republican group, or, you know, in different countries, the different political groupings would change. And this would immediately cause a very worldly feeling to arise in the monastery, worldly atmosphere, and would undoubtedly lead to dissent and bad feeling. And then, of course, the effect on the society at whole would be that, say, in a monastery identified with a particular political party or a particular political program, then the people who would choose to go and make merit in that monastery or choose to go and practice in that monastery would be monks, would be lay people who agreed with the political platform of the monks in that monastery. They would identify with them and support them in their political views and activities. Then, of course, in the case that monks were to be involved or affiliated with particular groups, then the political groups which disagreed with those groups or considered themselves opponents or even enemies would start to look on those monks similarly as opponents and enemies, and perhaps if they were to get into a position of power might seek to curb the activities of those monks and start to make life very unpleasant for particular sanghas. This kind of thing can be seen in history in countries like Japan, for instance. And the reason why in Theravada countries the neutrality of Buddhist monks as regards particular political movements, political programs has been so zealously maintained, at least in Thailand. And we know, unfortunately, in other Theravadan countries in Southeast Asia, those countries were subject to colonization. And as the monks had historically been the leaders of society in so many ways, they were called upon and expected to lead the struggle against the colonial powers. And so in Sri Lanka and Burma, we find the neutrality of the Sangha was severely weakened and in fact disappeared through the colonial period and has not really returned. In Thailand there is a very, we can say, pure tradition in this regards. But the role of the Buddhist monk as a refuge to all, as a friend to all, as a good friend to every member of society is, I think, a very good standard to be upheld. But that doesn't mean that Buddhist monks should shy away from any kind of controversy or any kind of social development which would lead, in that monk's view or in that sangha's view, to the reduction of the conducive conditions for growth in Dhamma of the people in that community or society. But the teaching is given on the level of Dhamma. This is what the Buddha taught. This is the principle involved. The Buddha said that such and such an action is unwholesome because it inevitably arises from this or that defilement and leads to growth of this and that defilement. And then the lay Buddhists are encouraged to take away that general principle and apply it to the current situation or a current development and see whether or not there is a movement away from principles of Dhamma Vinaya or a movement towards, a movement consonant with principles of Dhamma Vinaya or a movement which is in conflict with it. This is the role of the lay Buddhists to implement, to expand upon the basic principles of Dhamma with the underlying idea of trying to maintain conditions, in, as I say, in one's family, in the, in one's local community, in the society at large, which make it easy to be good, more easy to be wholesome than to act in unwholesome ways. And I think in any society, we need to have a small group of people who will strive for goodness and truth, whatever the external situation, external conditions. Similarly, you will have others who will act in very harmful and cruel and selfish ways, whatever the external conditions. But the vast majority of people are very easily led, and it's wise to create those conditions which make it easier for the easily led to be led in wholesome ways than in unwholesome ways. Now, all of this is, of course, dependent on the study and the understanding of these very important concepts of kusala and akusala, wholesome and unwholesome. These are basic building blocks of Buddhist teachings and give a firm, clear criteria for our lives, whether as lay Buddhists or as monastics. If we try to, although we may have clear ideas of conditions which are conducive and not conducive, but we don't really know what progress and decline in Dhamma really is, then we can still get confused and still lose our ways and still find suffering increasing rather than decreasing. In Buddha Dhamma, in the Dhamma Vinaya, we take the truths of the human condition as our basis. Buddha took the truths of greed, hatred, and delusion as fundamentals. These are dhammas, things which can be observed, can be experienced by everyone. And the Buddha said that any action, body, speech, and mind, which comes from, is influenced by, is dominated by, influenced by greed, hatred, or delusion, that is an unwholesome action, body, speech, and mind. Any action of body, speech, and mind which is driven by, inspired by, influenced by non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion is a wholesome act. So this is not merely a philosophical system, but it is a teaching based on the truths of the human condition, with the view that we do have this power and ability to recognize greed, hatred, and delusion, to abandon the unwholesome, to develop the wholesome, and to purify our minds. This is what makes the human condition so special. This is why the Buddha said it's a great acquirement, it's a gift, it's a wonderful thing to be born as a human being, to the extent that even devas and heavenly beings with right view, they often hope to be reborn as human beings rather than in any other realm. Because we do have this creative ability to grow in wisdom and compassion and to realize the truth and to penetrate the very profound happiness of non-attachment. So we have to develop this power to observe, to be present to our experience, the idea of learning from experience. And, said many times before, the religions that grew up in the Middle East form a family of religions which we can characterize as belief systems. But we cannot understand Buddhism if it's seen through the filters of or seen as another kind of belief system. And Buddhism is an education system, not a belief system. A system of training and education of every aspect of our life, both internal and external. The practice is one of developing that interest and enthusiasm for this education, to see the meaningfulness of it and the truth that only through this education can we find any true fulfillment in our life. We seek to educate ourselves, educate the way that we relate to the physical world, beginning with our physical body, being intelligent in terms of what we eat, how much time we devote to various activities in our life, how much to work, how much to family, how much to spiritual practices, how much to resting. This is an aspect of practice. If we consider Buddhist practice as meditation, then it's far too narrow a view of what the Buddha's teaching. This is a revolutionary teaching that affects every single aspect of our life. And being intelligent about diet is in no way separate from devoting yourself to sitting and walking meditation. They're all part of one education process. So we develop this sense of enthusiasm for this through reflection, wise reflection. And we see how through comparison the mind which has mindfulness and clear comprehension is so much more noble than the mind that lacks mindfulness and clear comprehension, to the extent that simultaneously with the arising of right view as to the value of mindfulness and clear comprehension comes the emotional component, which we refer to as hiri-otapa, and that's the sense of fear, wise, intelligent fear, wise, intelligent shame. That is to say, we sense a deep feeling of inappropriateness and a shrinking away from heedlessness. And we, through reflection on the law of karma, we feel a wise and intelligent fear of heedlessness, because we know we are confident of the karmic consequences of it. And this is how our behavior, our actions develop a clarity and a sharpness and an impeccability that they formerly lacked. So although we may, talking about Buddhism, we may talk about some particular aspect, but it's always developed in concert with, in harmony with other aspects, and has various repercussions. Let's say if we have an intellectual, let's say, discursive reflection on the law of karma on a regular basis, that doesn't just stop there as an intellectual activity, but if it's carried on with any kind of diligence and in the correct way, then emotional changes take place, particularly, as I've mentioned here, growth of hiri-otapa. Now this relationship between the different aspects of the path, this kind of organic quality of this training, is something really worth observing. I think it's easy to see that if If we were to develop a loving kindness meditation, this is an inner practice, then there are results on the way that we behave towards other people. If we're constantly dwelling on words and thoughts of loving kindness and forgiveness, then inevitably we will start acting towards others, speaking to others in a more kindly way. But this is the movement from the inner to the outer. But there is also perhaps a less commonly observed movement from the outer to the inner. That is to say, if you take that first precept of not killing very seriously, with great sense of respect and scrupulousness, then you'll find that you are constantly reaffirming the intention not to harm. Whenever the intention to harm arises in the mind, you refrain from it through the mindfulness, the recollection of a precept. So mindfulness always needs to have an object. So in the social and the physical world, the object of mindfulness, the peg for mindfulness, that is most effective are precepts that you've taken on voluntarily because you see the value of them. And then in daily life, they help you to be mindful because they give you something to be mindful of. So in relationship to the world of living beings, we're mindful of the precept not to harm. Now, constantly refraining from the intention to harm means that that intention to harm receives no nourishment, and over a course of time it gradually atrophies, it becomes weaker and weaker. And this has the effect on promoting the quality of loving kindness within the heart. So a daily practice of loving kindness means that one acts in a harmless and friendly way, and at the same time the training of sila and the refraining from acting in harmful ways promotes that quality of loving kindness. So there's this constant movement between the inner and the outer, nourishing each other all the time. If you were to have a daily meditation practice, a daily metta practice, but didn't keep that first precept, then the metta, the power of metta, would never really grow, never really attain any power and any real radiance, because there's always this sense that of inconsistency, and that one's not really acting in one's daily life, acting consistently, truthfully upon the principles which one is seeking to exalt in one's meditation practice. So this is see the inner and the outer affecting each other in a very profound and intimate way. And only by giving attention to both is there real progress in Dhamma. Now in daily life, say we through seeing the value of sati and mindfulness, clear comprehension, a sense of chanta arises, effort. But we also need to be constantly observing what are those conditions that help us to be mindful? What are those conditions that make it difficult for us to be mindful? In what situations do we find it easy to be mindful? In what conditions and situations do we find it difficult to be mindful? This is the kind of observation and interest that we need. It's constant interest in causes and conditions for the arising, the sustenance, the passing away of both the positive and the negative, the wholesome and the unwholesome. This is how the wisdom faculty has to inform our practice on every level. The in terms of the formal practice, there are a lot of different views and opinions about formal practice, and there are many different meditation techniques and theories. And one of the important teachings in the suttas on this, I think it is actually given by, it's a simile given by Venerable Ananda in the Buddha's presence, and refers to a city, a border city with a big wall around it, and one single door in that wall. And Venerable Ananda said, if someone was to walk around the perimeter of that walled city and looking very closely to see if there were any holes in the wall, any tunnels underneath it, any ways over the top of it, and was to walk all the way around that walled city and find no means of entry into that city at all, then that person could conclude with great confidence that the only way into this city is through that gate. And the Ananda said, similarly, the only way into the city of Nibbana, or the realization of Dhamma, is through the abandonment of the five hindrances, development of the four foundations of mindfulness, the seven bojangas, or enlightenment factors. The abandonment of the five hindrances is the first step. Whether you're following the path of samatha, you're following the path of vipassana, or whatever Buddhist path you're following, it doesn't start really until you can find some liberation from the five hindrances. This is absolutely essential. And for those who believe that the practice to transcend the five hindrances is a matter of concentration practice or samatha practice, then look very closely at the Buddha's words, where he describes the hindrances as not only being obstructive of peace, calm, clarity of mind, but being weak, things that weaken wisdom. I think the Pali is banya dubali karana, and dubali means to make weak. It's to say that wisdom cannot arise as long as the five hindrances are present. There's no calm, there's no peace, there's no real happiness in the mind, there's no refuge in the mind, there's no clear seeing of the way things are as long as the hindrances are present. So the way of practice, no matter what particular form it might take, must aim at the transcendence of the five hindrances, must go beyond the five hindrances. And when the five hindrances have been abandoned, the realization that they have been abandoned starts off a very important train or process in the mind. There is the feeling of pamoja, and this intense feeling of well-being, which matures into piti, or rapture, which matures into a sense of deep physical mental relaxation, which matures into a sense of sukha, very profound inner bliss, which results in samadhi, the firm unification of the mind, which results in the clear seeing of the way things are, and leads on to the abandonment of defilements and realization of Dhamma. The final part I've shortened somewhat. But But the point that I want to make here is that meditation leading to the abandonment of the hindrances is what leads to that important quality of pamoja and piti. And any meditation technique which can lead beyond five hindrances and give rise to that pamoja and so piti is one which is on the right path to the development of the satipatthana, the four satipatthana and the seven bhujangas. So you need to have this constant interest and caring for one's devotion to this practice, and observing constantly the effects of it, and the way that it ennobles the mind and uplifts the mind. Because the more that you can observe and see the positive effects of the practice, then the more committed to it that you will be, and the more faith in it that you will have. And this this path is a very practical path. It's one that has to be taken moment by moment, day by day. But it's also not like climbing a ladder, in the sense that you can be sure if you just stick at it, keep trying, you're just going to go up that ladder step by step. But it's more like going through a landscape. Like if you go through a mountainous landscape, you don't expect to just be climbing and climbing and climbing all the time. You climb up and you come down. There are mountains and valleys. And similarly in practice, there are ups and downs. And so the Buddha taught us to maintain an evenness of mind over the uneven terrain. And it's not to expect the terrain over which we pass on the, during our practice as being smooth and clear, and being disappointed and upset and discouraged when it's not. But the Buddha said we maintain that smoothness of approach through right view, through right aspiration, through the power of our faith and aspiration. And if you as you develop more calmness and clarity of mind, and you can experience moments or periods when the hindrances are not present, then you reach an important point also, in that you have a measure of the defilements. Temporary suppression of defilements gives you a breathing space and allows you to see defilements as defilements. Unless we have a non-defiled experience as a gauge, it's very difficult to see or really to understand what the word defilement means. In fact, may have some kind of emotional reaction to it, or want to think up an alternative translation for the word. But that word was chosen by the Buddha out of his own experience, to see that from the point of view of the calm, clear, radiant mind, greed, anger, jealousy, irritation, anxiety, fear, all these things are defilements of that. They sully it. And that sense of something radiant and clear, bright, being sullied, is one of the wisdom, one of the aspects of wisdom that arise through the meditation practice. So you see the unsullied mind, and you know what the sullied mind means. When you have an experience of the undefiled mind, then you have some idea of what the word defilement means. So we start off with all these words and we have some basic grasp of them, but these are all fingers pointing at the moon, they're all arrows pointing the way to something which is beyond language. And this is the importance of applying ourselves to the practice until we have an experiential understanding of the theoretical teaching. This is theoretical teaching is based very firmly and clearly upon existential truths, but we have to pierce beyond through the words to the states, the realities that those words refer to. So even if this is a long practice, it may take a long time to reach the enlightenment, then it doesn't really matter, and it's not an all or nothing practice, because if we're practicing the correct way and in a wise way, we feel happiness and joy on every step of the path. It's not like some way up in the future everything is going to be all right. But it's got to be all right now, because only the happy mind has the resilience to be able to investigate dukkha. You may have the intellectual capacity to understand it, but the emotional obstructions, such as fear, you know, of course, being the most obvious one, will prevent you from realizing the truth unless you have this deep inner sense of contentment and happiness with your following of the Buddha's way. When the mind is happy and feels self-sufficient, feels content, then it's ready to see the arising and passing away, ready to see the nature of dukkha. So happiness is in no way to be denigrated, but it's the happiness of the abandonment of the unwholesome, development of the wholesome, purification of the mind moment by moment, which is the foundation for penetration of the Four Noble Truths. So I'd like to offer these few reflections to you this evening.